Good afternoon to everyone here and also virtually. Great technology can be a wonderful blessing. Well, studying the books of the Bible can definitely be challenging, as I think some books are harder to understand than other books. And I was thinking about this a little bit. If I could pick the most challenging books, for me at least, I would say like Leviticus is a tough one. Ecclesiastes, Galatians, very tricky Galatians. And I definitely think they had Revelation. I think there's a lot in there that we don't understand. A lot that we do understand, a lot we don't understand yet. So more studying needs to take place. But I would also submit that the book of Job is one of the most difficult books to really understand and to comprehend. And I don't really think that you can get it in a casual reading. It's really a book to really ponder and think about, study, and reflect upon. So I'd like to go through the book of Job. And we're first going to see that God, this is interesting, God initiated the whole saga of Job. It was God that initiated the entire account. But as we're going to see, it was not simply to punish Job, but to really was to bring him to, we could say, the next level spiritually. We're going to see that the first three friends that visited him ultimately had a wrong view of God when it comes to understanding why do people suffer? Why do people suffer? We're going to read of the mental torture that Job went through as he tried to understand, why am I going through all of this? Why am I suffering so incredibly bad? Because here he was, a good man overall, one that feared God, but God appeared unjust to him. He took the pain in the beginning, but then he had second thoughts, as we're going to see. He really wrestled with God, and he sunk into some really deep depression along the way, even despair. He continued to defend his innocence, but his three friends made things worse, accusing him that he was a great sinner, and that really was what was going on with Job. Here's a verse to consider before we even start. Let's go to John chapter 9, book of John. John chapter 9. John chapter 9. And just in verse 3, Jesus answered and said, neither has this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. That the works of God should be manifest in him. The reason for suffering. In this case, the individual is blind, as we alluded to with Helen Keller in verse 1. The innocent do suffer to accomplish God's higher purpose. But Job did not really understand this truth. He was presumptuous, and as we'll see in his suffering and depression, he said sinful things to God. But God loved Job, and ultimately he responded to him. It took a while, but he ultimately responded. And Job saw his error and repented. He was blessed once again. And at the end, he did go to that next level. He was spiritually stronger. Now, that's the Reader's Digest version of the book of Job, right? But I think that we all have gone through it at some point, and it's not a surprise. I don't think I revealed the surprise ending or anything like that. So let's go to the book of Job, because, yeah, that's kind of the overview, but we have to dig a lot further than that. We go to Job chapter 1 and verse 1. It says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. Now, it's interesting, the original form of Job's name in the Hebrew can actually mean, where is my father? Where is my father? It could also possibly mean no father, which would suggest that he might have been an orphan or illegitimate, but we can't be definitive on that, but I think it's interesting to think about. Here's another question. Was he even an Israelite? Was he even an Israelite? It just says the land of Uz, right? It's believed to be in Edom, southeast of Israel. Just a question. And it says, there was born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance was 7,000 sheep. That's a lot of lamb dinners. 3,000 camels, 500 yokes of oxen, 500 she-asses, and a very great household. So that this man was the greatest of all the men in the East. His sons went and feasted in their houses, everyone on his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. It was so that in the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. It says, thus did Job continually. So right off the bat, is Job an evil man? Is he someone that, is an enemy of God? It's the total opposite, right? He's not carnal. If he was, then we could say that the suffering that's about to happen, well, that's justified, right? Because Job was a terrible guy, right? And he kind of deserved all the things because of all the evil things that he did. But Job was upright. He would even sacrifice on behalf of his children in case they went a little too crazy. It appears on their birthday that they were celebrating and went too far with eating and drinking too much. So he was concerned about his family. And this is how he operated. So far, so good, right? So far, so good for Job. But in verse 6, it says, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them. And this is where God initiates it. The Lord said to Satan, why are you coming here? And Satan said, where are you coming from? And Satan said, from going to and fro the earth, walking down on it. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? Do you know about this guy, Job? There's none like him in the earth. He's perfect and he's upright, one that fears God and stays away from evil. So God is initiating this with Satan. And God knows what he's doing. He's very clever, to say the least. And because Satan answered in verse 9, and he says, well, does Job fear God for nothing? Come on, God. Why does he fear you? Why does he respect you? Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and about all that has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. Of course he thinks you're great. He's blessed. Life is great. Sure, he's going to honor you because life is so good for Job. But he has an idea, Satan, or a challenge, really. Verse 11, but why don't you do this, God? Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. That's exactly what's going to happen. Take it all away, and Job's whole attitude is going to change towards you. What a challenge to God. And God said, okay. Behold, all that he has is in your power, only upon himself. Don't touch him. Don't touch him personally. Don't do that. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. We had permission. So again, God initiated this test of Job, not Satan. And we already have a very, very important concept to think about here, that God is in charge. God is in charge, not Satan. Not Satan. I've talked to people in the church years ago, through the years in the church, and some say, I had such a terrible week. All bad things are happening in my life because Satan is getting to me. I have no power, and that's the cause of all my problems, is Satan, is winning the battle. And that is a wrong idea. That is not a right idea, that Satan can just like walk all over you or walk all over God and do whatever he wants to do. The real important concept, God is in charge. He directed Satan, well, go ahead and do it, but don't touch him. And Satan had to obey that. He had to obey what God allowed him to do. Now, Satan's purpose was what? He really wanted to destroy Job spiritually. I mean, that was his modus operandi. He wanted Job to curse God. And God's purpose, as we're going to see, was, as it always is, for a good purpose. He wanted to, in essence, get Job and strengthen him spiritually. So the question becomes right away, will Satan be right? Will Job ever curse God? Will that happen throughout the course of the book? In verse 13, there came a day, we don't know how long, but his sons and daughters, they were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And there came a messenger to Job. And he said, it's unbelievable, Job. The oxen were plows, the asses feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans fell upon them, took them away. They have killed your servants with the edge of the sword, and I am escaped alone to tell you. And it says, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God has fallen from heaven, has burnt up the sheep, the servants, and consumed them, and I am only escaped to tell you. And here we go, verse 17. Another said, the Chaldeans made out three bands. They fell upon the camels. They carried them away. Yes, they've slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I'm telling you about it. And then we even have more in verse 18. Your sons and your daughters, they were eating and drinking wine in their elder brother's house. And became a great wind, some kind of tornadic activity from the wilderness, and smote the four corners of the house. It fell upon the young men, and they are dead. And I am only escaped to tell you. Unbelievable. An unbelievable series of events. And you think about it, Satan acted, when he acted all out. He let it all go forth, just in a fury, because he had a mission. He wanted to see it all taken away, so as quick as possible, in his mind, Job would curse God with what happened. That's what he wanted to do. But Job arose in verse 20, and he tore his mantle, his robe. He shaved his head. He fell down on the ground, and he didn't curse God. He worshiped, and he said, in verse 21, famous scripture here, right? Naked came out of my mother's womb. Naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. What a comeback. What an incredible comeback. And verse 22 says it very plainly. In all this, Job did not sin. He did not charge God foolishly. He did not condemn God. He did not blame God. He did not curse God. He just took this incredible series of events and remained an upright man. He passed that first test. He passed the first test. In any event, God knew that a second test was needed. Chapter 2. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Satan came also to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where are you coming?" And he answered just like the last time. And then in verse 3, he says, "Well, hey, what about Job? What about Job? There's none like him on the earth. He's still perfect and upright man. He fears God, stays away from evil, and still he holds fast his integrity, although you moved me against him to destroy him without cause." So God adds that last thing. "Even though all those things I allowed you to do," and God is sovereign, so he, you know, it was from his permission that this happened. He's like, "He hasn't cursed me. He hasn't cursed me, Satan. You're wrong." And then Satan said the following, verse 4. He said, "Skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has will he give for his life." Satan, very clever. You know, scholars have pondered over this first part here, skin for skin. In the context, it appears, this is one way of looking at it, that Satan was implying that Job was willing to give the life of another to save his own. You know, skin for skin, right? In any event, we see in verse 7, Satan went and he smote Job. God allowed that. With sore boils from the sole of his foot to the top of his head. And he took like this potsherd to scrape himself, scrape his skin, and he sat down among the ashes. Now the question is, what's going on here, you know, medically speaking? What kind of disease was this? It's not really clear what was going on, but the description of pain and sores over your whole body, I think that would be enough, right? You know, that you are suffering and you're hurting on every part of your body, right? And actually later in the book, it indicates that he also had fever and inflammation. So he is in incredibly bad shape, incredibly bad shape. Satan really was buffeting him. Now, in verse 9, his wife, Job's wife, never named who she is, she says, are you still going to retain your integrity? Are you still going to, you know, be happy about what God is allowing? Why don't you just curse God and die? Just curse God and die. And maybe she felt that his disease was so painful that, you know, why don't you just curse God so he'll just kill you? be gone with all the pain and suffering that you're dealing with, right? But Job answered, he says, "What shall we receive good at the hand of God? And shall we not receive evil?" And it adds, in all this, Job did not sin. He did not sin. He did not curse God. His wife's clearly influenced by Satan, right? His wife said exactly what Satan said, that Satan said that he wanted to happen, that he would curse God, but he refused. He refused. And he passed his second test, but now we come to the core of the book, and we have the introduction of Job's friends and this back and forth dialogue as how should Job's sufferings be viewed? How is it understood of what he is going through? What are we to make of it? What are we to make of it? Verse 11. Don't worry, we're not going to read every line of the book. And also don't worry, this is going to be more than one sermon because it's such a big book. Actually, there's just a lot. There's a lot here to really talk about. But verse 11, it says, "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came everyone to his own place." And here we have the cast of characters. Eliphaz, the Temanite, the Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Namathite, for they had made an appointment together to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted their eyes afar off and did not even know him, like, don't tell me that's Job? That's someone that looks horrible. They lifted up their voice, they cried. They cried when they saw him. That's how horrible he looked. Probably looked completely disfigured. They tore their robe. They sprinkled dust on their heads towards heaven. Verse 13, so they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none of them spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. So how long did it take for the three friends to visit Job? It probably was not just days, but it could have been weeks. It could actually have been months, because they would have to have found out about this by word of mouth. You know, there's no cell phones. Hey, you hear what happened to Job? Let me text that, you know. That's not going to happen back then. They would have to have heard it by word of mouth. They would then have had to make arrangements. We don't know how far away that they were. And then ultimately make that trip. But in their minds, Job was, you know, Mr. Popular, Mr. Rich. You know, hey, who's a rich guy? Job. Wow, incredible wealth and a prominent man. And he is reduced to nothing. Here he is, just, you know, lying in a pool of ash, so to speak, completely beaten up physically. That's what they found, and they were so shocked at seeing him. They didn't even talk. They didn't even know what to say. How do we even respond? How do we even start to say anything? Because his life is like completely ruined from when we knew him. Well, we come now to called the dialogue chapters. And there's these alternating speeches by Job, and then his friends speak. Sometimes Job addresses them, sometimes he addresses God. But we're going to see there's a big difference between Job and these three friends. Job is just openly talking, and sometimes he talks directly to God. The three friends don't do that. They don't. They stay away from God. They're just talking to Job. But Job was letting it all hang out. Chapter 3 and verse 1 says, "After this, Job opened his mouth, after this time has gone by, and he cursed," not God, but he just cursed his day. What does that mean? He curses the day of his birth. You know, he had taken the initial pain. He had accepted the tragedies in his life. And, you know, that's the patience of Job, right, you hear about. But at some point along the way, he kind of cracked. He mentally cracked. Again, we're talking probably weeks, even months, where it wasn't getting better. And we can certainly assume he was praying to God and asking for deliverance, and nothing happened. He just was miserable day and night. I'm sure losing sleep, just in pain, constant pain. And all the thoughts of everything's gone that I had, even my wife has turned against me. Right? That's what he thinks about. verse 2, he said the following. Verse 3 in Job chapter 3, verse 3, let the day perish where I was born, and the night which it was said. There's a man-child conceived. We have a baby boy. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. This is a man in anguish. He is absolutely in mental anguish and depression. He never wanted to be born. He wasn't making this stuff up. Life is a gift from God, and God had blessed him. But he was like, but the way I feel now, I don't want to live. I wish I was never born, because this is how I feel right now. And I think it's interesting that the one thing that made Job crack, so to speak, was personal physical suffering. I think that says a lot. You know, we're at anguish when others are suffering, loved ones, and there is sadness and grief with that. But the idea of chronic pain, and you can't sleep, and you just feel miserable, it's going to affect everything about you. It's going to affect your mental attitude. It's just going to destroy your hopes and your dreams. It could, because of that chronic physical pain. And if we have gone through things in our lives related to that, guess what? That's why the book of Job was written. That's why the book of Job was written. It's written for experiences that we can have like this, and that we can learn the lessons that Job went through. In verse 20, let's go there. Went blank, is that?
It's okay.
That's okay. Oh, okay. Verse 20. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul? He is in bitterness in his mind, which longs for death, but it does not come. He wanted help. You know, maybe if I get some sleep, maybe I'll just die in my sleep, and I'll be happy. I'll be happy with that. Which longs for death, but it comes not, and dig it for more than for its treasures. Verse 22. Which rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid, in whom God has hedged in? So he's asking some rhetorical questions, right? Why is light given to a man who's miserable? Why give life when there's no future? And he longed for death in his misery. And he felt that God had hemmed him in with no escape, which was not true. But that's how he felt at this time. Verse 24. For my sighings come before I eat, and my roarings are poured out like the waters. For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come to me. I was not in safety, neither I had rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. It's almost like the worst thing that he could ever imagine. You know, what if it was all wiped away? You know, I hope that never happened. I hope I'm never just suffering physically, you know, and just beaten down. But he's like, the thing I really feared, it's actually happened to me. Like, that's what I'm dealing with right now. Well, he's speaking honestly, right? He's despondent. And what is it, how can we sum up chapter 3? It's like even a person of great faith can fall into despondency. You know, Job was a man of faith. He was an upright man. He was a good guy. And it's talked about more later on in the book. But even he fell into despondency. That's something important to think about. We can also learn, I think, when we feel depressed and we feel there's no future, it's not a time to run away from God, but you've got to go to God in prayer and open up honestly. And we'll see how Job does that. Well, now it's time for one of the three friends to respond to all of this. Eliphaz, he's the oldest of the three, and they're, hey, you go first, you know, you're the oldest, we'll defer to you, okay? And if we read quickly through what he says and the other two friends, we can say they have a lot of good things to say. But you gotta look at the subtle and sometimes not so subtle things that they say that are absolutely wrong and not true about God. That's why we have to be very careful as we take a look at this. Let's start in verse chapter 4. Chapter 4, it says, the first gentleman, the oldest one, answered, and he says this, "If we attempt to commune with you, will you be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking?" I have to say, I've been not speaking for all this time. Now I can finally say it. I got my chance. "Behold, you've instructed many. You have strengthened the weak hands." So far, so good. He's complimenting Job. "Your words have told him that was falling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you faint. It touches you, and you are troubled. Is not this your fear, your confidence, your hope, and the uprightness of your ways? Remember, I pray you, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off?" Now, right here, we have to stop and say, is that true? Is that a true statement? Do the righteous suffer? Well, you know, we've just been through the Passover season. Let's see, the most righteous man who ever lived, Jesus, did he suffer? You know, I mean, that's the most no-brainer of, you know, statement of them all. Yeah, the righteous do suffer at times. The perfectly righteous Jesus suffered incredible. That first, this is already wrong thinking going through Eliphaz. Chapter 5 and verse 6, because he's continuing here. He says this, "Although affliction comes not forth of the dust, neither does trouble spring forth out of the ground." What is he saying here? He's saying that, hey, trouble just doesn't happen, Job. You must have caused your own problems. You had to be why you have experienced such horrible trials and suffering. Because you must have brought it on, and things don't just happen. Come on, Job, think about it. Think about it. But he's being presumptuous, isn't he? Of course, he has no idea what has happened, neither does Job, how this all started. He did not know that God initiated this test, but he was presumptuous that, Job, you're suffering, you had to have sinned, not just sin a little bit, you must have sinned greatly. And being presumptuous is actually a sin. It's not just a mistake that you make. But when you presume something and you make a judgment call without getting all the information, that's a sin. That is actually a sin. He should not have assumed that it was Job that was causing all of these problems. Verse 19. "He shall deliver you in 6 troubles." Hey, this is what God does. "In 7, no evil is going to touch you. In famine, he'll redeem you from death. In war, from the power of the sword. You'll be hidden from the scourge of the tongue. You won't be afraid of destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine, you're just going to laugh. You won't be afraid of the beasts of the earth. You'll be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the fields will be at peace with you. Everything's going to go great. You shall know that your tabernacle will be in peace. You will visit your habitation and shall not sin. You shall also know that your descendants, your seed will be great, and your offspring as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in a full age, as a shock of grain comes in for the season. Boy, this is his view, that if you are upright and like Job was, that only good things can happen. Everything's going to work out great. You're going to have a fantastic life. You're going to have children. You're going to live a long life. You're going to have possessions. Nothing is ever going to bug you. That was his view, Eliphaz's view of how God deals with humanity. But, wow, these are actually really cruel things that he said to Job, if you think about it. They were very cruel because Job didn't have any possessions anymore, did he, right? And his children were dead. And Eliphaz is saying, well, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. Job, you're not upright. Why don't you just admit it? Because all these things happened. They should not have happened to you if you really were upright. Very cruel that he touches upon this. And Job was offended, or took offense, we could say, at it. Chapter 6, he said, "Oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed and my calamity laid in the balances together." He wanted some intervention. Like, I can't believe you just said that, and I wish that I can get some justice, because that is not true. That can't be true of why I'm suffering. No way it can be, no way that can be true. He kind of wished for a judge to enter and condemn those conclusions, which were wrong. He goes on to say, verse 8, Job speaking, and he goes back into his depressed thoughts. "Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me the thing that I long for." That was death. "Even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then should I have comfort. Yes, I would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One." Job goes on to say in chapter 7 and verse 3, "So I am made to possess," note this, "months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me." You know, we just take this at face value. His suffering, again, wasn't just a few days, but we're talking months. It just went on and on and on, and things are not changing. His suffering is continuing to be in place. Verse 4, some more words from depressed Job. "When I lie down," chapter 7, verse 4, "I say, well, when will I arise and the night be gone? I'm full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day." Could not sleep. I don't know about you, if I don't get a good night's sleep, I'm done. This was happening, you know, day after day for him. My flesh is closed with worms and clods of dust. My skin is broken and become loathsome. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. They're spent without hope, without any hope. Oh, remember that my life is wind. My eyes shall no more see good. The eye of him that has seen me shall see me no more. Yea, your eyes are upon me, and I am not. As the cloud is consumed and vanished away, so he that goes down to the grave shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. These are the words of a chronic sufferer, months months of futility, of nights tossing in pain, and he was absolutely wearied. Verse 17, he said, "What is man that you should magnify him, and that you should set your heart upon him, and that you should visit him every morning and try him every moment? How long will you not depart from me or let me alone till I swaddle down my spittle?" It's an expression, you know, for a single moment. In the King James, it says, "I have sinned." It's really the context is, if I have sinned, you know, what shall I do to you, preserver of men? Why have you set me as a mark against you, so that I am a burden to myself? Wow, he just complaining. And, you know, he's saying, what is man? You know, David says, hey, what is man? Man is crowned with glory, and, you know, great things are going to happen. And Job's like, what is man? Man's going to just get, you know, suffer and die, and that's going to be it. Two different ways of looking at life. Two different ways. Well, now we come to friend number two. Friend number two. His name is Bildad, the Shuhite, and which shows that he's one of the shortest men in the Bible, the Shuhite. Thank you for the incredible laughs and reaction to that. That's an old, old Bible joke. Too old. Okay. He said the following. Well, how long will you speak these things? Hey, Job, are you going to keep blabbing on about this? How long shall the words of your mouth be like a strong wind? Yeah, it's like you're like blowing wind in our face. Does God pervert judgment? Does the Almighty pervert justice? If your children have sinned against him and he has cast them away for their transgressions, if you would just seek to God quickly and make your supplications to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and make your habitation of the righteousness prosperous. Wow, he really blasted Job, but he is also extremely callous. He is indifferent to Job's sufferings. He's basically saying, you know, your children got what they should have received. They had to be horrible sinners. That's why this directly happened. And, you know, if Job, if you would be doing things right, you wouldn't be in the position that you're in. That's how Bildad had this worldview of how God operates with humanity. Now, he also probably thought that he was really being helpful, that he's helping Job to wake up and realize, just admit it, you know, tell us what you did, how bad you've been, and maybe, you know, God will, you know, do something for you. But you just have to admit it. These things can't happen to a righteous individual. Bildad was so sure that he was right, but he was wrong. He had incomplete understanding. You know, that shows us if we ever do counsel a friend, we're trying to help somebody along the way, that we have to be really careful to try to get all the facts. You know, that's the most important thing about counseling, is that you want to gather as much information as possible. You don't want to jump to conclusions or just, you look at one side of a story and then go with that. You have to try to figure out what is collectively going on. Someone like Bildad did not have all the information, yet he was coming to all of these conclusions. Not good. Not good. Job replied in chapter 9. Chapter 9. And he said, "I know it is so of a truth, but how should man be just before God?" How can a man be just before God? If he'll contend with him, he can answer him one of a thousand. So I think he's telling Bildad, hey, you know, you actually said some right things. You said some right things. But still, in Job's mind, there's no justification for God to buffet him like he was. In verse 17, he breaks me with a tempest. He multiplies my wounds. Notice what Job adds, without cause. Job concluded, there's no reason why I'm going through this. No reason at all. Now, that was obviously wrong. But he did not know what had transpired between God and Satan and what God allowed Satan to do. He didn't have that information. But he was so sure he did have all the information. And he just was completely mystified by everything. Chapter 10 and verse 1. Boy, really, if you think Job was despair, you know, wait till you read some of the words in this chapter. Chapter 10 and verse 1. He says, my soul is weary of my life. I will leave my complaint upon myself. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. So he's just so, one thing about Job, he's unbelievably honest. He just pouring out his feelings, not holding anything back. He really gets to the depths of despair. We'll just read some of these words here, verse 16. He says, it increases. You hunt me like a fierce lion. You show yourself marvelous upon me. Verse 18, wherefore then have you brought me forth out of the womb? Oh, that I'd given up the ghost, that I had died and know how I'd seemed. Again, he's going back to, I wish I was not born. I should have been as though I had not been. I should have been carried from the womb to the grave, just be stillborn. I mean, this is real despair talk from Job. Are not my days few? Verse 20. Cease then, let me alone, that I may take comfort a little. Before I go, whence I shall not return, even to the land of darkness and the shadow of death. A land of darkness, as darkness itself, and of the shadow of death, without any order, and where the light is as darkness. Wow. But you know the good thing, even in despair, he was still talking to God. He still was communicating with God. He still realized, that's the only place to go. I don't know why I'm going through this, but who else can I appeal to? I have to go to God. I have to go to God about this great trial. Well, that's Bildad's first shot at it. We have friend number three, which is Zophar. Chapter 11. Just read some of the things that he said. Does he have the answers? Does he have the right attitude? Verse 2 of chapter 11. Should not the multitude of words be answered? Should a man full of talk be justified? Should your lies make men hold their peace? And you, when you mock, shall no man make you ashamed? Wow. He didn't like what Job had to say. Verse 13, if you prepare your heart and search out your hands toward him. You know, if you just admit, Job, how terrible you are, the things that you have done, that would be a big start. He has the same problem as Bildad. He assumes Job is a great sinner. Job needed to repent. Job had to wake up about how he's lived his life. That's why he's suffering. But again, we know that that was not the case. That was not the case. Job responds sarcastically to him in chapter 12. Chapter 12. Job answered and he said, no doubt, but you are the people and wisdom will die with you. You know, when you're dead, that's it. All the great thinkers and the wise people, that'll be gone because, I mean, you sum up wisdom so far. Obviously a sarcastic statement. Verse 3, but I have understanding as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Yes, who knows not such things as these? We'll jump to chapter 13 and verse 4. But you are forgers of lies. You're of all physicians of no value. You know, you're here to help me. You think you have the answers to get me better, but it's all a lie. You're not helping me at all. You have no value at all. And these are friends, probably old and dear friends to him. This is his conclusion at this point. Verse 10, about God. He will surely reprove you if you do secretly accept persons. Okay? Job was right. God is he's going to reprove eventually the three friends, but that happens later in the book. Let's go to chapter 15. Chapter 15 and verse 5. We're now back to the first individual, the oldest, Eliphaz. In chapter 15 and verse 5, he says, your mouth utters your iniquity, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, Job. Not I, your own lips testify against you. So he's not holding back. Job, you're just deceitful. Your words are terrible. And I'm listening to you, and you're terrible. Don't you realize you're incriminating yourself? Again, this Eliphaz, as the others, they had a black and white view of humanity, that if you sin, you always suffer, right? If you have a good life and riches and prosperity, you have to be good. You have to be good. That equals goodness. If you're suffering, you're in poverty, you're in suffering, you have sinned. That's it. The black and white, simple understanding. That was their worldview, and that just was not true. Is not true. Is not true. Chapter 16. Chapter 16. Job complains again. What's new? He said, verse 2, I've heard many such things. Guess what? How I sum up you guys. Miserable comforters, you are all. You're trying to comfort me, and you are miserable comforters. You know, the opposite is happening. And he even starts to think of God as an enemy. Verse 11, God has delivered me to the ungodly. God has turned me over to the hands of the wicked. Well, God didn't do that. It was not God's purpose to bring Job to sin, to bring Job to renounce and curse him. That was never, of course, God's purpose. God loved Job. He wanted Job to see things very deeply that he'd never seen before. Okay. Bildad in chapter 15, he has a response, but basically he doesn't really say anything new. He just kind of babbles on the things that he's been saying. Again, he did not have all the facts. In chapter 20, Zophar, he has a chance to speak again. Okay, Job answers him in chapter 21. And in chapter 22, let's just notice this in verse 5, that Eliphaz says really, really one of the worst things that he says, among a lot of bad things. In chapter 22 and verse 5, right to Job, he says, hey Job, isn't your wickedness great and your iniquities are infinite? Job, the suffering that you have, you must have been an incredibly bad person. You must have been incredibly bad things, because that's how life works. You're suffering so much, you must have sinned so much. That's how he said in his presumption, in his presumption. But Job was not an awful man. We know that from the beginning of the book. We know that. Chapter 23. Verse 8, Job says, "Behold, I go forward, but he is not there," meaning God. "Backward, I can't perceive him. On the left, where does he work? But I cannot behold him. He hides himself on the right hand, and I cannot see him." This is sometimes the conclusion of people that are suffering, even godly people. Like, where is God? You know, I've prayed, I've beseeched God, and I'm still suffering. And I have basically no answers. Nothing is happening. Whatever I do, nothing is happening. Where is God? It seems like he's gone away. But, you know, that is also one of the great lessons of the book of Job, that God is there. God is always there. You might not think he's there, but he is there. And sometimes it takes a while to answer. But at this point, Job wasn't seeing it. Let's jump to chapter 29. I think this is the saddest chapter of all, because Job starts reminiscing. He starts thinking back at the good old days, and they're all gone. Chapter 29. Let's read a couple of scriptures here. In verse 2, he says, "Oh, that I were as months past, as in the days when God preserved me." So he's thinking back, he's talking out loud. "I wish I had those days back. When his candle shined upon my head, and when by his light I walked through darkness, as I was in the days of my youth, when the secret of God was upon my tabernacle, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were about me." Wow, he's just thinking about his family. He's thinking about the good life that he had. Verse 7, "When I went out to the gates of the city, when I prepared my seat in the street, the young men saw me, they hid themselves, and the aged arose and stood up." I had respect in the community. I was prominent. And he said in verse 15, "I was eyes to the blind, and feet I was to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and the cause which I knew not, I searched out. I did good things." And he's telling the truth. "I helped other people. I had the ability through my prosperity to help others out." And he really enjoyed that. But, you know, it's all gone. It's all gone. Just a memory. Just a memory. Chapter 31. We're getting to the ending of the words of Job. And let's read verse 35. Chapter 31, verse 35. "Oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me, that my adversary had written a book." Yeah, there's going to be the book of Job. "Surely I would take it upon my shoulder and bind it as a crown to me. I would declare to him the number of my steps as a prince. I would go near to him." The last thing he says, verse 40, "Let thistles grow instead of wheat, and cockle," or the weeds, you know, instead of barley. And it simply says the words of Job are ended. So what does he end on? He ends on, "I am absolutely innocent. There's nothing that can explain my suffering. Where is God? He's gone away. I wish I, you know, could plead my cause and you know, refresh his memory that I am a good man. Why is this happening? There's no reason. There's no reason that this could be happening." But he was wrong. He was wrong. Chapter 32 and verse 1. It says, so these three men ceased to answer Job. And notice the last phrase, because he was righteous in his own eyes. He was righteous in his own eyes. And bingo, that is Job's issue. That Job was so sure that he was right. He was so sure that no one could answer him and explain why he was suffering, that it was completely wrong. It should never have happened. Should never have happened. Now, I don't think you put Job in the same class as the Pharisees, but he did not have the right to presume what God was doing in his life. He had no right to say, God, you have to answer me. You got to answer me now and tell me what is going on and you know, make it right. No, he did not have the right to do that. We should never push God. You know, we can beg God, we can plead with God, certainly in times of trials, and that's good that we do that. But we should never tell God what to do or tell God, you got to be wrong. You know, this is not the way that I should be treated. So change your ways, God. Never, ever should we ever come to those conclusions. And we're just going to end with why not? Well, let's go to our final scripture here in Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah 55 has scriptures that completely shed light on what Job needed to know and understand. Isaiah 55 and verses 8 and 9. God says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." So all the best thinking that we can do, all the conclusions we can come to, all the information that we gather, you know, we can't ever assume that we know it all, and we have all the understanding, and this is the way things should work. Because we don't have the mind of God. And, you know, that's why we have to always go to God to show us more than what we have seen. We're going to see later that God did not like Job's brashness and how he concluded things. And that'll be in the next time that we have the opportunity to go through the book of Job.